providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Dana Lyons as he provided more trading strategies for a wide range of markets. We're going to shift our focus a little bit in the last two segments as we are now chatting with Mark Chandler, Managing Partner at Bannockburn Global Forex, also editor of the Mark to Market website. Now, Mark, we wanted to talk with you about the real estate sector in the U.S., especially commercial real estate. But let's just start off broadly here with a recent article that you published on Barron's talking about community banks. So the smaller institutions here that do have more exposure to the real estate market. Mark, just start us off with a general summary of what you wrote in that article, please.
Sure. So I wrote it with a colleague of mine, Nancy Seeley, who's an accountant on our team. And the gist of the argument is something like this. We all know about the big banks. They had problems last year, and the Federal Reserve came up with a new facility that ends next month to help them out. The small banks, these are like the regional banks, your small banks in your neighborhood, we call them community banks, tend to be relatively smaller, of course, than the large banks, maybe at $10 billion or smaller market cap. And so what's happened is that a lot of the commercial real estate loans were made by these community banks. And they are not, because they're not systemically important, they tend not to get as scrutinized and have a lighter regulatory burden than the large banks, which seems to make sense. The problem is that these small regional banks have little offsets. We've seen after last year's experience, we've seen the uninsured deposits leave. We know that the small banks don't have the huge trading operations that a lot of the large U.S. banks have. So the problem then is that the exposure to commercial real estate, which is not, you know, why is commercial real estate having problems? Partly, it's the type of commercial real estate we're speaking about is primarily office buildings. Now, I know there's some people who think that the rent-controlled New York apartments was a major cause of New York bank problems that were big in the news. But it's a much bigger problem. It's not just, you know, it's funny to me is that many of us are well aware of China's property market problems. But for the most part, it seems contained to China and Chinese investors. But the U.S. real estate market is not just about U.S. community banks. But of course, there's global investors in there. We've already seen Japanese and German banks having to boost their loan loss provisions because of the U.S. real estate market. So the problem seems to linger, and I'd say the Federal Reserve knows about it. Not only did Fed Chairman Powell speak about it at the 60 Minutes last weekend, but also the Federal Reserve does a stability report twice a year. And the last one, I think, came out in November last year, and commercial real estate was the highest. It was like, you know, in their survey of market participants, it was the most important of the potential systemic risks. So this is a problem that's probably going to still be like unfolding. It's hard to know who's sort of like as Warren Buffett said, right? When the tide goes out, you see who's not swimming with a suit on. Last week, the regional bank index fell by about 7.25%. We're down most of this week, but we're down about 2% now on the week. So another down week for us, but it's just something to keep an eye on and how it could affect other people besides those who know about their real estate exposure. One is that pension funds and other asset managers have bought other derivatives that might have commercial real estate embedded inside of it. Sort of in the same way that during the great financial crisis, some investors unknowingly, maybe in their pension fund or some other investment fund that they are involved with, had some U.S. Real estate exposure then too, and levered and whatnot. And maybe it was those ninja loans, no income, jobs, or assets. And they got loans, and those loans were repackaged and sliced and diced in numerous ways, giving the wider sense of exposure. It doesn't seem that the commercial real estate market issue is as big, but I think that many of people will find that they have unappreciated exposure through some other passive investment they might have, whether it's their pension fund or some mutual fund. Also, globally, there's, like I mentioned, there's some exposures. But what does this mean? I'd have a list here of things that could get the Federal Reserve to move more aggressively to cut interest rates, and things that would slow them down. The strong jobs data, the above trend growth, that might slow them down from cutting rates. On the other hand, financial risk coming from commercial real estate could reach that tipping point and could become a more of an important factor in the trajectory of Fed policy.
Yeah, Mark, I think it's really interesting because when that New York Community Bank information came out and it dropped so hard, I think it got chopped in half in just a week's time. That was really affecting the KRE, the bank ETF, and the KRX, which is also an ETF that follows the small and regional banks. But then it came out that Azora Bank in Japan and then the PBB Bank in Germany were having the same things exposed to U.S. real estate, in particular commercial real estate. And as you say, Powell, in the press conference that he did with 60 Minutes, did address that some of the smaller banks may fail. So a lot of people are looking at this potential contagion effect, as you mentioned, like commercial real estate being involved in so many assets, being a factor that could get the Fed to move sooner rather than later, as you outlined. Do you think that there's a lot more skeletons in the closet with other banks where we're going to see the shoe drop? And will that actually mean more mergers and consolidation? Because what cured the problems last year were other larger banks coming in and acquiring these smaller banks, but are there enough banks that can make acquisitions if we start seeing dozens of these banks go under?
That's a good point. I think that some of the large banks might be barred from takeover. I think that the Federal Reserve wants to see them grow, many of them grow organically rather than through mergers. So that would really mean two things. One, either other regional banks bulk up, or some of these banks just go out of business. And to the point, really, is that arguably the U.S. is already still overbanked. On the other hand, that the bank that sort of like was the canary in the coal mine, New York Commercial Bank, NYCB, that had bought a lot of Signature Bank's assets. So that's part of the rub with NYCB is that it was one of the shining knights. And now that shining knight is having problems. And so I think that's really becomes the issue of how to protect these banks if there's going to be weak banks, strong banks taking over weak banks. And, you know, China's trying to do the same thing. The weak banks being taken over by stronger banks. And that often, just as we see with NYCB, transfers a problem if it's not fully addressed. And that's the challenge. So I'm not sure. How far the story plays out. But I do know that people like myself are watching some of the same small regional banks that we were watching about a year ago. And people tar them with the same brush and are looking for, you know, poking around and looking for exposures and weaknesses. And I think this still has some room to play out.
So, Mark, on the contagion question then, clearly the markets don't seem all that concerned with the S&P now over 5,000. But can we put a number on just how big this issue could turn out to be if there will be contagion into the markets, or if the Fed actually does step in and start up another kind of short-term facility to save these banks?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard for me to put a number on it, but I would say that it's unlikely that the Federal Reserve comes up with a new program to help these small regional banks. And I say that because, you know, after the great financial crisis, there is a rough agreement among countries about how to unwind a banking crisis or how to address a banking crisis. And because these at an individual level, these banks do not rise to the level of systemic importance. And that's part of the problem, is what's systemically important for the whole United States might be different for a community. In some communities, you know, like we have in the U.S., some places have one grocery store, if you're lucky, you know, close by. And many communities are served by only one bank. And so some of these communities, if they lose that bank, There could be a ripple effect through that community, but it won't rise to the level of systemic importance. So I hear you. Stock market, S&P, huh? Above 5,000. And still, the bank stock's struggling. So I think that it speaks partly to what we've talked about before, and what I'm sure your other guests have talked about as well, just the lack of breadth in the stock market with the Magnificent Seven or the top 10 companies accounting for the bulk of the rallies. Bank stocks, especially small regional bank stocks, aren't part of that mix. And in fact, it'd be the last 8 weeks. Regional bank stocks have fallen for 6 of those weeks. So that brings us back into the middle of December. So yeah, I think this is the problem. It's not just an important point I'd say again, is not that these banks are systemic one at a time, but a whole group of them could become a systemic risk. And even if they don't, the hardship that falls on the community that sees its community bank fail or go out of business is problematic for, you know, it has a ripple effect through the community.
Well, Mark, just talking about, you know, bringing this all over to the markets and looking at, you know, the S&P above 5,000, it's not just the S&P that's broken out to new highs. It's also the Dow that did it at the end of last year and did it again earlier this year, last month. Same thing with the NASDAQ. So really across the board and the weighted indexes, you've seen breakouts to new highs in the markets. As far as the market breadth phenomenon, that's mostly relegated to the small caps. And there are certain sectors like financials, or you could also argue energy, that have been laggards. One of the philosophies out there is that the laggards will remain laggards and that you'll see people continue to pile into what's working. Do you see that happening as the year unfolds, that people just keep piling into the sectors that are working and it's more of a dynamic market where there's the haves and the have-nots? Or do you think eventually this broadens out into a larger market rally?
Yeah, it's a good question. I really don't know. I mean, my sense is that this is late stage. And I wouldn't expect small cap stocks to do necessarily well in this late stage of this expansion. Because remember what's going to happen, even if we don't know the exact timing of it, the Fed's going to be cutting interest rates, not just because inflation is slowing, but also because the economy itself is slowing. And we might not see that. I mean, there's, of course, all kinds of signs below the surface, but for GDP measures, it's not there yet. So I think it's more of a second half story. But, you know, in the fourth quarter of last year, the Russell 2000 did almost as well as the S&P 500. So the real disconnect seems to me to be happening now, this year, and 6 weeks into it, rather than some kind of longer term structural development.
Mark, what happened to the relationship between what we were seeing, where dollar moving down, markets moving up? We can even tie that in with yields too. Yields moving down, markets moving up. That hasn't been the case this year. We are about a month and a half in, but throughout this year, markets have been moving up as the dollar and yields have been moving up.
Part of the reason, I think, you know, you've got these short-term correlations in the financial markets, which aren't stable. So I try to look for like phases and look for correlations within certain, like, sort of like within a certain phase, there's, you could count on the relationships, but then you move into a different phase and you can no longer count on those relationships. So I kind of think that since, say, call it the beginning of Q4 last year, I'd say that the driver has been, first it was down with interest rates, down with the dollar, now higher interest rates, stronger dollar. And throughout this, to your point, Corey, is the stock market has just gone up. So to me, it's the stock market that's not following the script. The dollar and interest rates are more closely tied, more stably tied, I think, than interest rates, the dollar, are related to the stock market. I think the stock market seems to want to go up. And partly, I think that the U.S. has still got the commanding heights of the global economy. The U.S., you know, other countries, of course, have become more important, have risen GDP. But the U.S. still has the commanding heights of the economy and faster growth than Europe. And we're likely to see that driven home next week. We get the final reads from the Eurozone GDP. We get the UK Q4 GDP. We get Japan's Q4 GDP. And I think that sounds kind of weird to say this, but once again, I think the U.S. is the driest towel in the rack. And by that, I mean that the growth potential, what the U.S. growth record is, Q4, what it's looking like early here in Q1, still out, you know, far and away is better than Europe. And because of that, I think that people think that that translates into higher profits, stronger stocks. And so I think that until proven otherwise, I think people stick with that.
Well, Mark, isn't it also the case that the narrative changed from last year, where it was really recession watch. And are we going to have a soft landing or a recession? And now most people have acknowledged that the recession is nowhere close to being even on the field. And it's more of a, you know, are we going to, like we talked about last week with you, are we going to have a soft landing? Or are we going to have an acceleration in the economy? It seems like the biggest sea change has been last year. Bad news was good news because it meant that the Fed may start cutting earlier. Now it seems like the market and even financial media has shifted to good news is good news, because if you have better than expected jobs, better than expected GDP, better than expected consumer confidence, that's translating into, hey, this is a strong economy and companies should have profits. Isn't that kind of the change we're seeing in 2024?
I think you're right. I think that it's changed. But, many people who I read and I respect, though I don't always agree with them, haven't given up on this recession call. They see a lot of problems lurking below the surface, and are sort of like bemused, confused by how the calculation shows GDP holding up so well. So I don't think that people. So for me, there are some people who are very negative on the U.S. economy, and they haven't changed their minds. And we're going to see economic data, I think, that's going to show the economy slowing, but very gradually. So that's the concern, I think. But I think you're right that right now the debate is between soft landing and reacceleration. And I think the Federal Reserve has fully given like a full endorsement as much as they can of a soft landing.
So, Mark, where do you stand in that whole debate? Because, look, there's always going to be people poking holes in the data on the good side and on the bad side. Depending on what that data is, there's always going to be people saying that the markets are in for a hard time, and there's always going to be the bulls saying, oh, bull markets climb a wall of worry. Where do you stand on not just the will we have a recession, let's say, within a year, but how markets will do during that time?
Yeah, so here's what I'm thinking is that the fourth quarter of last year, the U.S. interest rates fell too far. And we've corrected here the first 6 weeks or so of the year. And I think that correction is just about over. And I think that next week's economic data could help like solidify that it's over. And I'm looking at two numbers in particular next week that should confirm this. One of them is CPI. And the median forecast on Bloomberg, among the economists that Bloomberg surveyed, 2.9% year-over-year headline CPI. That's an incredibly low number. It's the lowest number in several years. And breaking that 3% threshold should be one of those things that boosts the Fed's confidence that inflation is headed towards its target, which brings forward then that rate hike that the market keeps pushing further and further back in time. We also will get next week retail sales. Retail sales is important because it's a measure of consumption, not full consumption. It's about 40% or so of U.S. PCE, personal consumption expenditures. But it's a timely number. It's mostly goods, not so many services. And we could see a contraction, partly because of the weakness in auto sales we've already seen. So we could see a 0.1, 0.2% decline in retail sales, coupled with the softer inflation number, should help, again, boost the Fed's confidence, boost the market's confidence about the Fed's confidence that inflation is on its way to its target. And maybe that suggests that we don't have to really write down more of a chance, reduce the chances of a May cut. And people are beginning to shift to June, and this might help bring us back into a May cut.
Well, Mark, just one more question on the Fed's 2% inflation target. I think a big change in the narrative at that 60 Minutes interview that Powell gave with Scott Pelley was he asked him directly, he asked Jerome Powell, are you committed to getting all the way to 2% inflation before you cut rates? And Jerome Powell said, no, that's not what we say at all. No, we're committed to returning inflation to 2% over time. I've said we wouldn't wait to get to 2% to cut rates. Now, that is a different message than they gave the markets last year, where they said they want to see it at 2% and sustainably at 2% for a period of time. Now it seems like they are willing to cut rates before it gets to 2%, as long as the trend is going that direction. You mentioned regional banks could be one of the things that would get them to cut early, but really right now, what impetus do they have to even cut by May when everything is going so well in the economy?
Yeah, so Shad, I think two points I'd say is one, I'd point out that the Federal Reserve's summary of economic projections, and you can find this on the internet, the Fed publishes this every quarter, And the Fed has said for over a year now, they've projected rate cuts in 2024 before their inflation target is reached. So to me, the fact that the idea is that monetary policy acts with a lag. And so if you wait till we get 2% inflation, it's already too late to begin cutting and to try to remember the Fed's goal is here is using monetary policy to try to make sure, try to boost the chances that we can avoid a recession. So that means cutting interest rates before you're at your target because the rates have a lagged effect on the economy. So I don't think that's the big change here. I think the tension is between the Federal Reserve saying three cuts this year and the market having priced in six cuts, maybe a little bit more than six cuts at the end of last year. And once again, it's like, who's going to move first? How are the two views going to converge? And last year, several times we saw where the markets got too far ahead of the Fed and would converge with the Fed rather than the Fed converging with the markets. This time, I think the Fed, as of December, had three cuts priced in into their forecast, the summary of economic projections. And I think that there's going to be a convergence around four cuts. And that would allow for a May cut. But I'm still not convinced that they cut in May, but I think that this is still a fluid issue. But I think that there's very little chance that the Fed stands pat all year. I think that the quality of the growth, I mean, it's hard to know, right? We're still early in the quarter, too early for the Atlanta Fed's tracker to be very useful, but it's above 3%. I think that the Bloomberg median view for Q1 is about a 1% growth. So we have to see how the numbers play out. That's why next week's numbers are important. It'll be the first sign of how the consumer is doing in the new year.
All right, Mike, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much for your assessment, first and foremost, on the banking sector tied in with real estate in the U.S. And now, again, still what everyone's waiting for is that Fed rate cut. Why, when, and how many this year? We won't know until we're at the end of the year. But boy, oh boy, it's a guessing game for everybody on pretty much a daily basis, too. So, Mark, thank you again for your time. Just as a reminder, you can follow along with Mark's market and economic commentary on his website, Mark2Market. Everyone, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Please go back through our website, kereport.com, and podcast The KE Report, as well as our new YouTube page, The KE Report, to catch up on all of our daily editorials and company updates, as well as full market weekend show recordings. Everyone, hope you have a great rest of your weekend.